Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump canceled an appearance at a major conservative political conference today near Washington, instead choosing to hold a campaign rally in Kansas, one of five U.S. states and a territory holding primaries and caucuses this weekend. Mr. Trump was scheduled to speak at the Conservative Political Action Conference later today, but said on Twitter he would not attend. Campaigning from Michigan on Friday, he continued his sharp criticism of his opponents, such as Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, and Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
You know that in Florida, they hate little Marco Rubio so much. It's true. Because of the fact that he never votes, he never shows up to vote.
Trump is going to try to build his lead over three rivals while also leading Democratic Hillary Clinton is trying to do the same over Bernie Sanders. Meantime, at today's CPAC conference, rather Friday's, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson officially ended his campaign for president. In Turkey, authorities there have staged a raid on the offices of Zaman, Turkey's largest circulation newspaper, in a crackdown on media outlets that support the political opposition. The action was linked to a government campaign against opposition media and opposition Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, who lives in the United States. Protesters outside the Zaman building chanted, "Free press cannot be silenced," and waved Turkish flags. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the number of people who have fled Burundi because of violence and political tension has climbed to 250,000. Burundians began fleeing the country almost a year ago after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced plans to run for a controversial third term and later won. In the political turmoil to follow, hundreds have died. This is VOA News. The United States is pressing the UN Security Council to repatriate UN peacekeepers if troops show a pattern of sex crimes. The U.S. is responding to a recent UN report showing a jump in allegations of sex abuse by the peacekeepers in 2015 compared to the previous year. UN Undersecretary for Field Support Atul Kahare says they take the allegations seriously.
We will not let up in our response to ensure that our prevention measures are robust, that where incidents occur, victims receive support, and allegations are vigorously investigated, so that, ultimately, justice is served.
However, the UN has no authority to prosecute peacekeepers for crimes. It can only send them home and hope their country of origin will follow through on prosecution. The UN Refugee Agency, meantime, is proposing a plan to help resolve Europe's refugee crisis. This move comes a week ahead of a European Union ministerial meeting in Brussels next week. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says the situation could be largely resolved if European nations would implement a plan they agreed to last year for the fair and equitable relocation of refugees. Fleming says most of the countries are unwilling to face up to their responsibilities, as only 603 people have been relocated.
It's not fair that Greece and Italy have to take on all of the people who are arriving and all that that entails, and it's not fair that Austria, Germany, and Sweden, for on behalf of all of Europe, have to take the burden of all the refugees who are arriving.
The UNHCR is proposing a six-part plan to EU member states to manage and stabilize the refugee situation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A senior Afghan diplomat says he remains optimistic that peace talks with the Taliban will start within days. The Afghan ambassador to Pakistan, Hazrat Omer Zakhilwal, tells VOA there's a lot happening in the background to get the talks underway, but a security official in Pakistan with knowledge of the efforts Islamabad is making to persuade Taliban to send someone says no headway has been achieved so far. The U.S. has deployed an aircraft carrier and several escorts to the South China Sea in an apparent show of force to China. China claims almost the entire South China Sea and has been building artificial islands in the sea to strengthen its claims. American author Pat Conroy, who chronicled the beauty and pain of growing up in the American South, is dead at the age of 70 after a bout with pancreatic cancer. Conroy's publisher announced the news late Friday. The lyrical prose written by Conroy described often troubled family relationships juxtaposed with descriptions of natural beauty in coastal South Carolina, an area known for hospitality and gracious living, but also a dark history of racism and slavery. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
And this means that this has gone through as goals which are universal,
right.
Adapted, should be accepted by all and lived up to all, rich and poor, that they are built on sustainability.
A top-ranking United Nations official says he is pleased with the global implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals.
We have done this against a brutal and suppressive behavior of the ruling party, the PF, and the president, who has taken a decision to suppress citizens and unleash the police force on harmless and armless citizens.
The Zambian main opposition leader urges his supporters not to engage in acts of violence ahead of the August 11 general election.
He says the government wants to turn the tide by establishing centers to train young and ambitious professional participants in the country's fishing industry.
And the demand for fish is rising in Cameroon, a country with access to the Atlantic and rich with rivers and inland bodies of water. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Deputy Secretary General of the UN, Jan Eliasson, says he is very pleased with the ongoing global effort to implement the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, countries committed to implement to improve the lives of their citizens. Last year, over 190 world leaders pledged their commitment to 17 SDGs to end extreme poverty, fix climate change, as well as fight inequality and injustice in a bid to attain equitable, more prosperous and sustainable world. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Mr. Eliasson told me the UN is happy that member states created a set of goals which could positively change the path toward development within the next 15 years.
Well, first of all, we are very pleased by the fact that the member states unified around these goals in September last year. It was not certain that they would keep this high ambition. My experience of international negotiations is that you sometimes have lowest common denominator and come up to some compromise product. But in this case, we are extremely happy that the member states really created a set of goals which could change the path we go on development in the next 15 years. They are already starting to implement them on the national level. Mm-hmm. This is the first year, this is the second month of the first year, and already we have 25 nations, close to 25 nations, wanting to tell us in the summer when we have a big meeting on implementation what they are doing. And this means that this has gone through as goals which are universal,
right.
Adapted, should be accepted by all and lived up to all, rich and poor, that they are built on sustainability, by that uniting the agenda of the Sustainable Development Goals with the climate change agenda of Paris in December, that they are inclusive, that it has to reach everybody, and that we must have the ambition to fight inequalities and reach those who are furthest behind. Leave no one behind, we say. So it's a message of solidarity also. But of course, this requires that this is translated to national realities and national plans. And I think the trend is very clearly going in that direction.
So despite the commitment they've shown so far, what are some of the challenges they're facing along the road in the implementation process?
Well, the challenges is that I can tell you, when I was foreign minister in Sweden many years ago, I was in the parliament and I only met the development committee or the foreign affairs committee.
Right.
Now these new goals, they affect all sectors of government and all sectors of society. We can't achieve these goals if we do not enter the area of how we organize our transportation systems, how we organize our energy systems, how we organize the agricultural structures, the industrial structures, how we deal with migration and urbanization. These sectors are traditionally, in many countries, seen as domestic.
Right.
But that's not correct anymore. In today's world, we are interdependent and these goals are interrelated. Mm-hmm. So we need to take away that false, artificial at least, line between national and international. Mm-hmm. In today's world, the good international solution, read migration, read climate change, mm-hmm. is in the national interest of member states. Mm-hmm. That is a new culture, and we need to really make sure that everybody has a responsibility now to contribute. And that's a culture change which usually takes some time. But I am encouraged by the fact that this new thinking is taking hold and leading to positive movements and decisions by member states.
Talking about migration, what are your views about the current situation in Syria and the migration crisis that, you know, the region is facing?
Well, my absolute conviction is that in today's world where you have so many turbulent developments, tragic developments, we need much more to focus on the root causes and the conflicts that often lead to grave consequences. Look at Syria, where you have a disaster for the country, a humanitarian tragedy of epic proportions. You have effects on the neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, very serious such. And now you even have an effect on the political life in European countries. Mm-hmm. Polarization, right wing, left meeting, and the middle squeezed. And then you have the cohesion of the European Union under grave danger. So we definitely have to look at the root causes of problems. And I think that the curse of conflicts, the scourge of war, as it says in the UN Charter, is our primary move now, move in the direction of dealing with the fragile states, going in the direction of solving conflicts, going in the direction of prevention. Why do we wait all the time for the disasters to occur? Mm-hmm. Did you ever see a headline, or did you ever succeed in making a headline?
I have not been able to do that.
That the disaster did not occur?
No.
No, because the news is only when it's a humanitarian crisis and a peacekeeping mission which is of enormous size. Mm-hmm. We don't understand that a crisis has a long life.
Right.
I would demonstrate this by saying this is the life of a crisis. Mm-hmm. It's a long life of a crisis.
Jan Eliasson is the Deputy Secretary General of the UN. He spoke with me from the VOA headquarters here in Washington, D.C. Allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation by UN peacekeepers and staff rose in 2015 despite the institution's zero-tolerance policy. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
A new report from Secretary General Ban Ki-moon released Friday says there were 99 such allegations last year compared to 80 in 2014. The majority, 69, were made against troops and police in 9 current and 1 closed UN peacekeeping operation. There were also 30 allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse against staff members. Atul Khare, Undersecretary General for Field Support, condemned such misconduct at a news conference on Friday.
That anyone serving under the UN flag should prey on the vulnerable is truly an abomination. We will never, never agree to protectors turning into predators.
More than half the peacekeeper-related abuse allegations were made against just 2 UN missions, MINUSCA in the Central African Republic and MINUSCO in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Missions in Haiti, Liberia, Ivory Coast, and Mali also had a substantial number of allegations, while peacekeepers in Sudan's Darfur region, Abyei, and Cyprus were the subject of 4 cases. A third of all the allegations involved the abuse or exploitation of children. 15 paternity cases have been filed. The UN has instituted remedies for victims, including financial compensation and a mechanism to assist and encourage victims in reporting allegations. The UN chief is calling for stronger accountability, as well as better preparation and vetting from countries providing troops. In cases of widespread or systematic abuse by troops from a particular country, or if a country does not cooperate with the UN in investigating allegations, entire contingents could be sent home. Repeat offenders could effectively be eliminated from the lucrative UN peacekeeping business. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The leader of Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, has called on supporters of the party to desist from engaging in any political violence. Hakainde Hichilema also called on the international community to monitor what he calls human rights abuses by state institutions like the police. His remarks came after Geoffrey Mwamba, a leading member of the UPND, was arrested and charged with unlawful drilling. Hichilema told me the arrest of Mwamba and 21 other opposition party supporters is the governing party's use of state institutions to harass and intimidate the UPND followers in the run-up to the elections.
We have done this against, a brutal and suppressive behavior of the ruling party, the PF, and the president, who has taken a decision to suppress citizens and unleash the police force on harmless and armless citizens, like it happened at Woodlands Police Station when my vice president was arrested. Our members were beaten, savagely beaten, brutalized, and by the police, and this is uncalled for. And the president has failed to end the violence that is going on in our country. So, and I'm aware that our citizens basically are in the position, in the mood to react and retaliate. That's why I've called them not to do that, because what President Lungu is trying to do is to instigate violence and then try and justify a call for a state of emergency, which the consequence of which is to avoid the 11 August election. And we don't want him to create that environment.
I've spoken to some supporters of the PF, and they said that there is nothing to show that the president is violent and nothing in his character has proven so, and that your accusations of him inciting violence, it's just to make your point because you have no legitimate opposing views that will better the lives of Zambians by way of policy that will alleviate the poor. And that is why you are accusing him of inciting violence. And that is unfortunate, they said.
No, that is totally misplaced. I think they are aware between their president and myself, I'm a better economic and business manager. They know that I'm a business person. They know I understand the economy. I'm trained in that area. And he's not, and we have demonstrated what our capability are. We create jobs when the president hasn't created any job as a person, as an entrepreneur. He has never done that. We have a deficit in food now. He exported food only 7 months ago. Again, it's my advice not to export food. Now, the food was exported, maize was exported at $200 per ton. Now we're having to buy the maize. Basically, literally, in other words, our own maize, we're going to buy it at $500 per ton. That's a loss of $300 per ton.
Your critics have said that you said you are a job creator. However, those who work for your companies are not being paid well. They cannot cater for themselves. And they said, their words, not mine, that your companies pay them so poorly, and if they utter any grievances, they are threatened and some are even fired. And that by so doing, you are incapable of creating jobs that will make Zambians comfortable in this economy. What do you say to that?
Absolutely not. We have been able to enable citizens to succeed in our own businesses. We got them first as employees over 25, 30 years. We have created independent citizens out of initially being our employees. We've done extremely well.
The general election is on August 11. What are your expectations in terms of the ECZ administering credible, free, fair, transparent election that will meet international standards?
That's our challenge now. Our challenge is to have a free, fair, transparent, credible elections. We want an open electoral process. Nigeria was able to do it last year. We need to do it in this country as well. to have a free, fair, transparent, credible elections, an open election process from voting through to counting to tallying to transmission of results and leading to announcement of results. We're expecting nothing short of that. And that is what we are asking the international community to pay attention on the elections in Zambia, because Zambians have decided to deliver change. And that's why the president is panicking.
Hakainde Hichilema is leader of Zambia's main opposition leader, United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A leading wildlife protection group says conflict in South Sudan has killed thousands of animals, including elephant, giraffe, and antelope. The government of South Sudan and the SPLA in opposition signed a peace deal in Addis Ababa and Juba last August. But there are still isolated incidents of fighting. In addition, armed groups on both sides are accused of killing wildlife to feed their troops. Paul Elkan is the Wildlife Conservation Society's program director for South Sudan. He gave an update on the situation to VOA's William Eagle.
Even from the very beginning of this fighting, both armies, the SPLA and the SPLA in opposition, that both of the armies used wildlife and systematic hunting to feed their soldiers. And that happened in a dry season of 2014 and dry season of 2015 as well. And that had a major impact, particularly on the Tiang migration. And, of course, these guys, and then we had cases where these different soldiers were linking up with commercial markets, and it turned in, it wasn't just a question of feeding the soldiers to do the fighting, it was actually for commercial gain. And during this time, we've been working with the Wildlife Service to cut down on that, and just last week, there was 19 SPLA soldiers arrested by the Wildlife Service with 62 antelope carcasses and 15 machine guns. And so we're in a situation now where, as peace is coming in and the ceasefire is taking place, some of these soldiers, some of private individuals are turning their guns on wildlife for commercial gain. And that's really what's striking right now. And that's the pressure we're dealing with.
What is the solution to this? Have you been in contact with representatives of the opposition and the government to talk about this issue and to find a way to resolve it?
Yeah, we've been in touch with both sides and all parties on this, including some of these other, there's various armed groups in the country. And, of course, they're quite preoccupied with their ceasefire and their deals and security. But we do see that there's sensitivity at the highest levels of both the government, of course, and then the opposition parties to work on wildlife-related issues. I think the problem now, of course, is getting this transitional government formed, and then I think we're going to get a lot of interest from both sides. We've also had some positive feedback from the commanders of the army of the SPLA when this recent arrest was made, where they said, "No, you're doing your job. We need to do it," but a lot more needs to be done. Obviously, there's a humanitarian crisis ongoing in the country. People are suffering, but now wildlife is suffering. It's frankly suffering more now than it has been in the past 2 years. And another thing that we're seeing is also elephant poaching seems to be expanding, and also ivory trafficking. And not just this, this gets across borders. We also have illegal gold mining happening, private companies trying to come in. And so there's this sort of a vacuum of power right now, which has yet to be filled, and it needs to be filled fast. And once it is, we're going to be engaging with all sides of the equation, and hopefully they'll adopt basically a crisis action plan to save the wildlife in the country.
You were saying earlier to me that there's quite a potential by protecting wildlife to help develop local communities or the economy. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. Before this war broke out, we had actually had several international ecotourism companies which were interested in building the first tourism infrastructures and operations in both Boma Park and Bandingalo Park. You know, we do think there is this opportunity that South Sudan, obviously, as security is put back in place, it can benefit from those jobs, from that revenue generation. And frankly, I think both the government and the opposition, they know that. And they've been there. They understand the importance of it economically.
Paul Elkann is the Wildlife Conservation Society's Program Director for South Sudan. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle from the capital, Juba. Demand for fish is rising in Cameroon, a country with access to the Atlantic and rich with rivers and inland bodies of water. Yet the Central African nation, home to an estimated 22 million people, heavily relies on imports to meet national demand. For VOA from Douala, reporter Ntarike Divine Jr. says the government is partnering with donors to increase production.
The government says Cameroon's consumers purchase around 400,000 tons of fish per year. That's way below national production estimated at 170,000 tons. As a result, the country spends over 100 billion francs, about $166 million yearly on imports. The country's livestock, fisheries, and animal industries minister, Dr. Tiger, explains the government's solution to the problem.
Le gouvernement a mis en place trois centres. Et il s'agissait donc de former des jeunes.
He says the government wants to turn the tide by establishing centers to train young and ambitious professional participants in the country's fishing industry.
Nous avons le centre de Diboncha dans la région du sud-ouest qui est...
Centers have already been established in Diboncha in the southwest and Douala in the littoral along the Atlantic coast. And by year's end, three more will be set up in Belabo in the east, Maga in the far north, and Longji in the south region. In mid-February, the Douala Professional Fishing Center sent off its first batch of 30 graduates after 2 years of theoretical and hands-on training. One of the trainers, Elvis Esome, tells me the program is also designed to attract young people.
We teach them how to fish, how to repair nets, how to preserve our resources, how to respect Cameroon law concerning the fisheries. We have to train more and more young fishermen in Cameroon in order to occupy all our coasts.
According to the government, 80% of fishermen plying Cameroon's territorial waters are better trained and equipped foreigners, mostly from Nigeria and Ghana. They are accused of conducting indiscriminate harvests and illicit deals, including the selling of their catch in markets outside Cameroon. They are also accused of disrespecting fishing seasons and zones. Large-scale Chinese fishing companies rank high among those blamed. Critics say they plunder resources with the bottom trawler fishing technique, which sweeps seabeds of fish. Tiger says young people have been discouraged from fishing by difficult access to funding, the use of outdated techniques, and insecurity in the country's coastal waters. But that's changing with increased interest and funding from the U.S. to develop aquaculture or fish farming. In addition, France is offering growing support in developing offshore fishing. French Ambassador to Cameroon Christine Robichon says her government has been pumping millions of francs into the modernization as part of France's debt development contract, or C2D, to help relieve debt and boost assistance to developing countries.
The contribution of the French government came through C2D, and the money was used to pay for the training center, the training itself, and also to finance this equipment.
She says several factors will improve fish production in Cameroon. They include strengthened regulations and control of the country's territorial waters and more incentives for young people, including improved access to funding for startups. These changes, combined with the new training centers, should come as a relief to consumers. The ambitious effort comes in the wake of spiking prices for meat and other sources of protein. For VOA News, I'm Tariq Devine Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotta, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
I'm sorry, Lulingo Testinga. Naye Katinchi Urida, Kapoya Fue Machinga. Anyway, Wagaliza, Wagaliza, Wagaliza Luna Kolulu,
Luna Kolulu,
Manorina Linze, Kulinzo Mulu,
baby,
Wagaliza, Wagaliza, Wagaliza Luna Kolulu.
Hello, my baby.
Jata, baby. Hola, hola, baby, it's a bit too gata. Hola, hola, baby, it's a bit too gata. Oh, my baby.
Homme d'affaires, Gango Youssouf Matoma, Yahya Hussein, Papa Grasse, Charles Ogada, Digital Entertainment Promotion. Ah, c'est ça. Mama Kibido, Maurice Oyano. Todie, Todie.
Oh, up.
It's not cause I'm not lying, I'm evil. And she used to love me, and I used to love her cause she's my first love. And when she's always by my side, I've never ever made me cry. Naughty, naughty girl, really made me smile. The kind of girl of my dreams. And then we promised to be together forever and ever. But one day, he come away with a funny look on her face. And when I asked me, angel, why? She said, because she came to say goodbye. Cause tomorrow she'll be dropping. He said, it don't not London, eh? And she told me to be stronger. He promised me, said he go call her. It's been 6 years and since she left, but still I haven't heard her voice. Place. I just didn't think about her pretty face and all the things that we used to do, including how I used to kiss her pretty lips. But right now I am so lonely, and it don't take, she still never called me. I don't know why, how to let her go, when this is the time that I need her most. I can't sleep without me, angel. I can't stop missing me, and I can't go on without me, angel. Now ain't that it for me, but right now I just can't help it, and I don't know how to fight it. All I need now, me angel, right here, and so I think, man, I gotta go.
Set,
And that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team today, managing editor Shaka Sally, producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineers for today, Nick Ivanov and Chris Martin, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, he who throws a stone in the market will hit his relative. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of Malawi may soon have a significant increase in the electrical power they need, thanks to a new agreement between the United States government and the government of Malawi. Malawian Minister of Natural Resources, Energy and Mining, Bright Msaka, U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, and Power Africa Coordinator Andrew Herskovitz signed a memorandum of understanding between the United States and Malawi regarding Malawi's continued participation in the U.S. presidential initiative known as Power Africa. Power Africa is a U.S. government-led initiative that helps bring critical power projects online and connects people to electricity by removing barriers, particularly the financial and regulatory roadblocks that have stood in the way of power delivery in sub-Saharan Africa. Power Africa represents the U.S. government's commitment to supporting Malawi to achieve its electrification goals and improve the quality of life for thousands of Malawians, said Ambassador Palmer at the signing ceremony. In Malawi, Power Africa support will complement an existing $350 million grant from the U.S. government through the Millennium Challenge Corporation, aimed at expanding access to electricity in Malawi. The United States is proud to partner with Malawi to help meet the country's electricity needs for a better future for the people of Malawi and Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.